Dismiss all anxiety from your minds and enter into the Call Me Catholic Show with your host, Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, we'll try to get to it in the next hour. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you've arrived at the Call Me Catholic Show, where we celebrate, explore, and affirm our Catholic identity so we can say to the world, oh yeah, go ahead, you can call me Catholic. As always, I'm happy to share the studio with my intrepid engineer, Jimmy G, who keeps us up and running. How you doing, Jimmy G?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
Good. Hey, so Memorial Day has come and gone. It must be summer.
I find that very hard to fathom.
I'm ready.
June 1st is the unofficial beginning of summer for me, so we're right around the corner.
Well, Memorial Day passes, and then I know I can wear white pants. So
there you go.
Hey, so we hope that you noticed that the Call Me Catholic show didn't air last week because of the station's pledge drive. They have special programming for that, and we thank the listeners who donated to that effort to keep Immaculate Heart Radio on the air. But we're back this week with another great lineup of guests for you on the Call Me Catholic show. We have a double feature Muse in Review coming up, where we spotlight some worthy of note art going on in the world. Canadian Catholic Timothy Schmalls, who is the artist behind the homeless Jesus sculptures appearing on park benches around the world, will be with us. And following that, we'll talk with filmmaker Howie Klausner, who has a great new family comedy opening this week called The Secret Handshake. But we always like to start the program with our Did You See This feature, where we discuss an interesting recent news story that has a Catholic theme to it. So, Jimmy G, you might remember that Pope Francis recently addressed a class of newly ordained priests about the importance of delivering lively homilies.
I did hear about that.
Yeah. He said quite, and I quote, quite bluntly, make sure your homilies are not boring. Yeah, I just love how blunt and just direct and to the point Pope Francis.
No secret message there. No, right to the point.
Well, congregations around the world were applauding that. But, you know, the Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit, Michigan was already way ahead of Pope Francis on that issue. An article in USA Today last week titled, Hallelujah, Actors Help Future Priests Amp Up Sermons, explained how Detroit's Sacred Heart Seminary enlisted two prominent equity actors from the area to run a preaching boot camp for those soon-to-be priests.
Wow.
And we have those two actors with us this morning, Arthur Beer and Mary Bremer Beer. Welcome to the Call Me Catholic show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You are the actors, and I will say for our audience, you are a married couple also, who were sought out to help these seminarians in the Detroit area step up the game with their preaching skills. So first off, who contacted you about this assignment, and what exactly were you asked to do?
Well, Father Michael Byrne was in charge of that program at Sacred Heart 5 years ago, and he got in touch with me because at that time I was chairman of the Performing Arts Department at U of D Mercy. He said he wanted to do exactly what Pope Francis said, that he wanted to blast these seminarians loose from traditional practices. He wondered whether we could do that, and I said we'd be glad to try.
And Father Byrne is now a bishop.
Oh, so he was a man who had some agenda. He knew what he was doing. Yeah, well, that's such a fabulous subject to address, because, you know, public speaking is something that Catholic priests have to do a lot of, but it's not usually what draws them to the priesthood. You know, Protestant ministers are probably much more compatible with that skill, because the meat of their service is a long homily. But, you know, the Catholic Mass is different, and there are other weightier transactions going on beyond the preaching of the scripture, and yet most Catholics walk away from Mass talking about what? The homily. So, do priests get that? Do you see the seminarians understand the importance of this?
Oh, yes. I don't think you'd go into this profession unless you realized you're going to be addressing a large public crowd every day, probably.
Yeah.
So, we don't have a problem with stage fright among these guys. For the most part, they have already done some public speaking, and they're highly motivated, so they're a great group to work with.
Well, what are the biggest obstacles that stand in the way of a well-composed and delivered homily, then?
Just the fact that they've heard so many homilies that were boring lectures. They're very intellectual, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to sound theological and sound as though they're lecturing instead of being conversational and direct and helpful to a layman.
And many times it's just getting over yourself.
Well, that's true in life, I think.
Right.
In most professions. Well, are there some exercises you use to help them with their articulation and their pacing?
Absolutely. We use the same same kind of exercises that we use in voice and diction classes for actors and that Mary has used for years in speech classes for general students.
Mm-hmm.
They call us actors in the program. It made some people, I guess, angry that they hired actors. But in fact, I have a MA and a PhD in speech and theater, and Mary does too. And we have 20 years experience at least apiece.
Acting, directing, and public speaking.
Well, if you've retained the job for 5 years, I have a feeling you're doing a good job with it.
They seem to like it.
And we enjoy it too. They have a lot of fun, and so do we.
Well, what do you think is more impactful or more strategic, crafting the right homily or delivering the homily in an effective way?
I teach delivery for an hour in the morning, and then Mary takes it over and teaches speech, the rhetorical principles, you know, how to do an introduction, how to do a conclusion, how to shape a body, all that stuff.
How to make your speech interesting, little things, little tricks that you can do to warm up your audience. If you're warm, they'll be warm.
Receptive.
Your audience will be warm.
Well, what are some of those tricks? I think our listeners would, you know, like to hear that.
Well, you know, some of them really. Sister Teresa, it was wonderful. In one of her books, she has a whole chapter on smiling.
Mm.
What a smile can accomplish. So, you know, that's coming right from the Catholic Church, right from her. And we show how that can work for them and what a smile can do. And, you know, other little things, humor, how mm-hmm. humor draws people mm-hmm. in. And humor and warmth and how to tell the story. They choose the content. The church chooses, the homiletics professors choose the content. But we help them warm it up.
Well, do you take into account different styles? You know, there might be one priest may be kind of fire and brimstone-y. That might come natural. Another priest might be a little more intimate in his storytelling.
That's rare.
Oh, is it really?
No, it's really
what's
common.
Rare?
Each have separate
styles. Fire and brimstone.
Yeah, we don't have fire and brimstone.
Not in the Catholic Church.
But yeah, they each have personal styles, and we try to strengthen their strengths and teach them how to overcome their weaknesses.
And many of them are in a bit of a shell, a bit introverted, and so, you know, we use some of the acting techniques to help them with that.
Mm-hmm. And do they critique each other, too? Do they listen to each other?
Yes.
We critique heavily, constructive criticism, and then as the workshop moves along, they are allowed to critique and learn, you know, the one thing they have when we finish this is a critical eye, mm-hmm. and one important thing, because they're able to work together and tell us what they see that they should be doing, and very fast that works, as it works in theater as well.
Sure.
We have a class of voice and diction, and then a class in speech, and then after lunch we have an hour and a half of acting exercises, which mm-hmm. is intended to get them out of the box, out of their habitual limitations.
Well,
free them.
Do they get to pick their material, or do you give them monologues from theater?
Yes, we give them materials.
They must have
mostly
a lot of fun with that.
They enjoy it too. They really enjoy it, and the classes have been as large as 25 to as small as 10, and they seem to really come close together through doing this. And one thing that's wonderful is they're very encouraging of one another.
Sure. Well, they're brother priests, and they're all going out into the brave new world together. You know,
right.
here in Southern California, we also have quite a few wonderful priests who have learned English as a second language. They know the language well. I mean, they really have a great command of the language, but their dialect really can interfere with their delivery. Have you had to address
yes.
that in your Detroit area?
Oh, yes. Middle Eastern. We have had several Middle Eastern priests.
St. Thomas here is the Chaldean church.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
We had three students from St. Thomas this time through, the one we just finished. Now, they all had local dialects. They'd all been here since they were small. But we have in the past had some African dialects and various.
So you can work with a dialect. You're that specific in your training?
I work with dialects a lot in theater.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Arthur teaches dialects as well. And it's interesting. They are really motivated, so they want to understand. And they work very hard. You know, it takes a lot of homework to do this.
Well,
that's why they call it boot camp.
Is it a one-day workshop, or is it a reoccurring
no,
thing?
It's 3 weeks altogether, and the last few days of the third week, they are delivering their homilies, and then we are having a critique session afterwards.
And they do it in front of a congregation in a church. We have several different churches that we've gone to. So we get to see the final product, which is great.
The audience also critiques them.
Yes.
Really? So you go into an actual mass, and you hand people critique sheets. That would be fun.
Congregation, yes.
Do you find the congregation is honest in their critiques, or are they harsh or generous?
They're not only honest, but they're thrilled. They just applaud like crazy. It's just wonderful.
You know,
it isn't during Mass. It's after the Mass they're asked to stay if they want to watch the homilies.
Oh, I see. So it's not during the Mass. It's like a
right
thing you invite. Oh, that's a wonderful opportunity.
But it's the same scriptures for the Mass of the day that are the basis of their homily.
Yes, and frequently they'll come up to the seminarians and say, oh, I wish you were at my church.
Oh, that's great encouragement for them. That's very affirming.
And the ones who were in our first camp are now, of course, fully-fledged priests out in the world, and we hear back from them also saying that they like what they learned and are using it.
Well, I think the priest, who's now a bishop, who came up with this idea was really very insightful, because I think the congregation really appreciates a well-delivered, well-composed homily. It's the takeaway from the Mass that you can talk about over dinner and talk about it with your friends and talk about it on the church patio. It really makes a difference. So, Arthur and Mary Bremer-Bitt, thank you so much for taking the time to explain to our Call Me Catholic audience how you're doing your part to keep us awake during the homily. We appreciate your input.
Peggy, thank you. We're willing to expand this program if there are any other seminaries around that would be interested in talking to us about this. We can leave a phone number with you, if that's fine.
Oh, well, you can give your phone number right now if you'd like, and I'll repeat it at the end of the show.
Thank you. 586-264-2611. Again, that's 586-264-2611.
Okay, well, that's Arthur Beer and Mary Bremer-Bitt, great actors from the Detroit area who are sharing their talents with our seminarians. Thank you so much. It's time for a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk with artist Tim Schmalz about his thought-provoking new line of homeless Jesus sculptures appearing on park benches around the world. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic Show. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin, with a Muse in Review double feature today. We have two great guests from the arts to share their stories with us. First up, it's a real pleasure to meet Canadian artist Timothy Schmalz, the Catholic artist behind the homeless Jesus sculptures that are starting to show up on park benches around the world. These are powerful bronze sculptures of a life-size man lying covered in a blanket on a 7-foot park bench. Tim Schmalz, thank you for being with us this morning to talk about your thought-provoking artwork.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, these sculptures, which are so profound, have been labeled homeless Jesus, and at first glance, they're remarkably lifelike. They appear to be a man huddled, kind of hunched under a blanket. His face is obscured under the blanket, but upon closer look, it's clearly Jesus. Now, can you explain to our listeners how you identified the person as Jesus?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's kind of a visual translation of Matthew 25, the sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
It works almost like theater. Initially, you're right, you're supposed to actually think it's just a normal homeless person on a park bench. In fact, it's been mistaken as a real homeless person. People in several different locations have called the police on the sculpture.
Calling the police on Jesus, that's not cool.
It's interesting, but unlike a lot of artwork that you see in museums, this one is in city centers and no pedestal. It's right there. It merges within the environment, and my hope is that the Gospels will merge within our world in a almost seamless way. But as you come up to the figure, you won't be able to see his face, so he becomes, in a sense, every person. And then the only visible acknowledgement that it is Jesus is the feet that are the only part of the body that's really exposed. You see the wounds of being on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because one of the first casts that we went to the University of Toronto at the Regis College, the Jesuit school, and a chaplain from another city, when he first experienced the piece, he thought, leave it to the Jesuits to put a life-size homeless sculpture in front of their entranceway. And it was only till he sat down on the bench, and yes, there is space to sit down, and he was about to touch the feet of the homeless man. It was only then that did he realize the wounds, and then he just had a moment, a eureka moment. And I think that's Matthew 25, the Gospels. There is that eureka moment where the apostles are bewildered. When did we see you thirsty? Mm-hmm. When did we see you hungry? Mm-hmm. And it's bang. Jesus says, whenever you've helped the least of my brothers. And it's at that point where the sculpture has that eureka moment too. And that's why it's subtle and discreet.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, I think it has the power of the gospel. And it's interesting because when I'm doing a gospel sculpture, what I love doing is holding the sculpture up in front of the Gospels. And if I see the Gospels clear through my sculpture, I did a good job.
Wow.
If I can't see the text, or if it's obscured, it's not a good sculpture. So what my artwork tries to do is take almost a visual translation of some of the most powerful ideas within the Bible and give them life.
It's not a traditional vision of Jesus, and yet it is so very scriptural. I mean, it's very, very authentic, and yet we really haven't seen this. Can you take us back to your first inspiration for this work, Tim?
Toronto, back to the big city. I used to live there. Now I have my studio in the country. Whenever I go into the cities, I'm confronted and shocked by the amount of homeless people I see.
Right.
And it was one November when I was driving on University Avenue on top of some of the stonework on the Bex Monument in the heart of the city of Toronto. There, right beside me as my truck pulled to a traffic light, was what was really haunting to me, because I saw a figure completely wrapped up in a blanket, very similar to my Jesus the Homeless. And at that moment, my eureka moment was, I said, I just saw Jesus.
Mm.
And for two minutes there, however long a traffic light is, I was profoundly taken by this what I'd consider a spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to my small town in St. Jacobs, my idyllic hamlet here, and I thought, I'm a sculptor. I should actually create a sculpture that hopefully will give people that same, or lead people to that same experience that I had there, that is very akin to Mother Teresa's famous quote that Jesus wears many disguises.
Yes.
Right?
Well,
and
exactly.
So the sculpture is a movement more than it's just an aesthetic piece to appreciate, more than just a kind of a piece of beauty. It's meant as a piece to shock, in the sense, people. It's just as shocking, though, as the Gospels are, and not a second more, I like to say. And the Gospels are shocking. Matthew 25, a lot of the other parts of the Gospels, they demand so much of us. They challenge us. And this sculpture hopefully will take that biblical challenge and just translate it visually, so it becomes a visual challenge out there in the city streets.
Well, it's easier to hear something that's uncomfortable to us, because we can quickly kind of dash it out of our mind, than to see something that really burns into your memory. You can't get away from that.
That is fascinating that you would say that, because although Jesus the Homeless is finding homes all across the world, what's still very strong in my mind is in Paris, the Oratory of the Louvre. The chaplains there expressed serious interest in having the piece right in the heart of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
However, at one of their meetings, they realized that how could we have this sculpture of Jesus the Homeless right there in front of our Louvre, the Oratory of the Louvre, which is actually where the chapel for the kings throughout the ages in Paris. How could we have this sculpture there when we try to discourage homeless people from coming to our oratory?
Wow.
And it's like, oh my God.
Moment of truth.
This is irony beyond belief. The same thing happened in Trafalgar Square, where 90% of the people at St. Martin in the Fields loved the sculpture and wanted to put it there right in the heart of London. However, they considered the ban on homeless people sleeping or lying down anywhere around their church. So how could they actually put the sculpture there?
Well, it's kind of a memorial to them. I mean,
you're not going to edit stuff out of the gospel, right?
No.
You're not going to take a black pen and
say, this doesn't work for us anymore.
The tourists that come by might not appreciate, right? But Christianity, although it's been a comfort, I'm a Christian myself, and although it's been an absolute comfort comfort to me throughout my life, and I think a lot of other people have the same experience. It also is something that shocks and challenges one. And I think that there's been an emphasis on the artwork to go to the comfort side, the comfort food of the visual art for Christianity, and not what I'd say some of the key aspects of the gospel are, which is challenging, right?
Well, that's right. And you know you've been successful when you do get controversy and you do get some negative reaction. You know, ooh, I've struck a nerve that they can't get away from. So that certainly has to be affirming to you as an artist that, yes, I've accomplished exactly what I want to do when I hear criticism. Now, among your many admirers is one very special man, Pope Francis himself. Did you present him with a model, or you presented the Vatican with a model of this homeless Jesus?
Yes, I gave Pope Francis the original model that was created. It wasn't a small thing either. It was around 5 feet.
Wow.
And it was an amazing experience for me because right there at St. Peter's Square, he prayed with the sculpture, and then he blessed it.
Oh, my. And so, is it staying there? Is the model staying there in the Vatican?
Right now, I'm in the process of working with some of the people at the Vatican about placing the permanent life-size piece, because the small one was only, like, the model that was meant for indoors. But God willing, shortly there will be one right in the heart of Rome, and I'm getting a lot of help from some of the people at the Vatican, and I'm working with the city of Rome. It's interesting, there's one right in the heart of Washington, D.C., and that only took 4 months to happen in the heart of the nation, the nation's capital. I thought that would take longer, but it was only 4 months. So hopefully it won't be that long before Jesus, the homeless, finds a home in Rome, which is very important to me because all the different artistic expressions of Jesus throughout the history, there must be more in Rome than in any other spot.
Oh, I know. So you'd be in the company of great Jesus art there. Now, since that first installation, you've been commissioned for so many other ones. Do you make each one differently, or are they all kind of cast from the same mold?
Yeah, well, what I did was I created the original in clay in my studio here in St. Jacobs, and then my hope is to make them all absolutely exact. So in the bronze process, what would happen is, or you'd make a mold, and then you'd cast additions of the piece. And there I go, and I make sure every little line
aspect
of the fabric is perfect and whatnot. And so right now, actually, I'm casting 12 new ones.
Wow.
And so it's just, and they're all going to different places. And what the hope is that most of the city centers around the world receive this visual representation of compassion and the Matthew 25 to be part of their city.
What you do for the least of my brethren.
Another great location, I just got back from Christ Church Cathedral in the heart of Dublin. And the great thing about that was I had Jesus the Homeless had the Archbishop of the Catholic Church of Dublin and the Archbishop of the Anglican Church in Dublin
do
a dual blessing with the sculpture.
Wow, that you
talking about heaven, to see the sculpture is even bringing together different denominations. The next day, I'm meeting with a patron who finances one to go to Belfast. And right now, the Catholic and Protestants are working on a joint symbolic event of placing the piece in the heart of Belfast at the City Hall.
Well, who would have known that your first inspiration when you passed that intersection and saw the homeless man? I hope somehow he got some consolation in knowing that he inspired this great work of art for you. Now, Tim, if our listeners would like to know more about your work or how to acquire some of your art, they can reach you at sculpturebytbs.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, Timothy Paul Schmaltz, TPS.com. But the easiest thing to do would just be to Google Jesus the Homeless. And not only would you be able to see hundreds of different photos, including Pope Francis blessing the model, but you'll be able to see some of the different stories that are attached to the different locations.
Oh, yeah.
And also you'll see my website. Easy first page, you'll probably can be able to click on my website there.
Okay, that's awesome. Well, Tim, clearly you've answered a higher call with this work, and we hope the Holy Spirit continues to inspire your art. Thanks so much for spending time with us on the Call Me Catholic show. We really appreciate hearing your story and knowing about your work. It's fabulous.
Well, thanks a lot.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back for the second part of our Muse and Review double feature, we'll talk with filmmaker Howie Klausner about his new film, The Secret Handshake, opening this week. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin, reminding you to stay with us here on the Call Me Catholic show. We'll be right back after this word from our station. Hi, and welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin. And by the way, if you have some questions or comments or suggestions for us, you can email me at Peggy, that's P-E-G-G-Y, at callmecatholic.com, and we look forward to hearing from you. We've got a Muse and Review double feature for you today because we know you like to hear what's good today in the world of arts. Now, our next guest would know a lot about that because he produces and writes good stuff for Hollywood. Filmmaker Howie Klausner is a 20-year veteran of film and television. One of his earliest credits was writing the script for Clint Eastwood's blockbuster Space Cowboys, and some other recent screen credits include Soul Surfer and The Grace Card. He also wrote and produced The Identical, and his latest movie, The Secret Handshake, opens tomorrow. Welcome to the Call Me Catholic Show, Howie.
Thank you, Peggy. I'm really happy to be here.
Hey, listen, you know what I love about your impressive list of credits? They're all good movies. I mean, they're all great. I loved Space Cowboys. That was that like the year 2000 or early 2000?
It came out in 2000, yep.
Okay, wow, such a great cast. You had Clint Eastwood, Tommy Lee Jones, James Garner. I mean, these were manly men reading your words. So that must have been pretty cool to write the script and then see these great actors employing your dialogue.
You know, it was exactly as you say. I've had wonderful, wonderful things happen. I've had a terrific, fun career, but that was pretty much the peak experience for me. My four favorite actors of all time.
I know. Gosh, I remember that. We have three sons, and we all loved it. It was such a great, just a classic movie. And you were the writer on that. Now, what had you always been a writer before that?
Yeah, I grew up here in Nashville, where I'm talking to you from, and I knew that we didn't have any sort of movie business or really even any television business back. I'm really, really old back in the day, and so I knew I had to come to Southern California, and I knew that this is what I wanted to do, and I thought that writing would be the speediest way for me to get to what I'm doing now. It only took 25 years, Peggy, but I'm doing what I'm doing now. So,
hey, well, you got right in there with the big boys when you did the Space Cowboys.
And that was the funny thing. It actually was the first script I ever sold. It took a lot of tries, I should say that, but you know, I kind of crashed in really, really fortunately where I did. The timing was great, and I had a terrific writing partner at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it just everything lined up right, and there you go. There was Space Cowboys.
Well, you also wrote Soul Surfer, which is that beautiful movie about the surfer Bethany Hamilton who lost her arm in a shark attack. Are these your ideas, or do people come to you and say, could you write something along these lines?
Well, it's a combination of both, and I want to make sure that I do get the record straight here. I don't think the studio would really mind me saying now. I don't even want to say the number. I was one of many, many writers on Soul Surfer.
Okay.
It took a long time to get it just right.
Right.
I was the guy they came to at the end and said, "We don't think we're getting Bethany's faith in God right," and that's kind of world I came from. So my job was really to sort of make her faith real in her dialogue. I more or less brought to life the character of her youth director. So that was my position on that.
What a cool thing to be identified with, though. I mean, that's a pretty neat component because that has to be authentic. And if they're coming to you, then they know you're speaking, you know, the right words to use that don't sound fake.
I guess so. That was the thing. And you know, God bless them to recognize that. I mean, you know, Hollywood is, as we all know, they're fine people. They just, you know, most of them are not born in this culture. They're not born in Christian or Catholic culture. So, you know, it's like, well, that's kind of what I grew up in. So it really wasn't that difficult to get that language and get the sense of it. And she is all that. She's a wonderful person.
She is. And you wanted to get that part right because that's a very important part of her story.
It was very important.
Now, you have a film opening tomorrow, The Secret Handshake. It looks great. You have Kevin Sarbo and Amy Grant heading up the cast. You wrote it and you're directing it. I mean, that's a pretty good start. How do you feel about it? Are you excited?
I am so excited about it. It's been an interesting journey for me, you know, because I really came up as a professional in Hollywood. And my wife and I really just kind of wanted to sort of get to a quieter lifestyle. So we moved back to where I'm from, back to the South here. And happily, I was able to get working right away. And I did some very, very overtly Christian films. And that was wonderful. I'm really happy I did that.
Mm-hmm.
But my real sweet spot is kind of, I want to be able to write things that'll play fine in a church sanctuary, and they'll play fine at the Megaplex.
Perfect.
And so, and that's really my approach in The Secret Handshake. It's a family movie, kind of in the old live Disney Frank Capra spirit.
Frank Capra. Wow, that's an awesome icon to hold up as a measure for your work. work, Howie. That's got to work for you.
Well, he's a hero anyway. I shouldn't say that. You'll be the judge of that, Peggy.
No, I love it. Well, this is, as you said, a family comedy about becoming a man, coming into manhood.
Right.
So what called you to this subject matter, Howie? Do you have some young sons?
You know what? I don't. I have three daughters.
Oh, you just needed a little testosterone in your household.
I really do. There's actually a funny line in the movie. The character is based largely on my life. He has three daughters as well.
Oh, okay.
And you know, on the more serious side, I lost my dad when I was 13. At this boy's age in the movie, and I always sort of had a story that I wanted to tell about, you know, because I mean that's a pretty tender age to lose the male role model in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And the quick storyline is there's a young man who's stalking one of Kevin Sorbo's daughters. Not scary stalking, but really just doing stupid stuff trying to get her attention.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to intervene, and instead of saying, "Hey, leave my daughter alone," he sees that this boy really, really needs some guidance. And Amy Grant plays his mother, who's a widow.
Mm-hmm.
And she reaches out to him and literally says, "What do I know about being a man?" And so that's the real beginning of the plot.
Okay.
And we're gonna mentor this boy with my friends. It's a comedy, but there's a lot of heart in it. And you'll probably tear up once or twice. Amy was amazing. So I cried when she shot her speech. It was that good.
Oh. Well, how long did it take you to write it?
You know, this was one of the fast ones. Once it really
starts flowing, you just go with it.
It really does. Two things happened in a month of each other, Peggy, that made it inevitable for me. I was speaking at a conference, and a man stood up in the audience. I'll never forget this as long as I live. He said, "Yeah, great. I love what you're talking about." He said, "Where are the movies I can take my family, my children, my in-laws to, and not be either bored, embarrassed, or insulted?"
I know.
And that's where I started, and literally less than a month later, a guy in my neighborhood wrote an email to 25 other guys and me and said, "Would you please write my son, who's turning 13, a letter about what he needs to know to be a man?" And bam, that was it.
That's a pretty clear message that that's where you're going to go with your script. Well, now my husband and I have raised three sons, and I say raised past tense because we're pretty much done. They're not married yet, but they're all working on their own. They're awesome guys. Mm. Shout out to Frank, Nick, and Charlie. But trying to impress upon boys the importance of growing into a good man is a little tricky today, even when you do have a great father figure in the house like we do. You know, I love that your story, it seems to take the guys out into the woods, and it kind of symbolizes the importance for boys to detach from technology and get their fingernails dirty again, right?
Mm-hmm. 100%. Peggy, I think we are living in probably the most confused time in human history as far as just, especially on the male side. We don't know what we're supposed to be anymore.
Yeah.
And it's tough, and we're living in like the third or fourth generation of extremely fractured families out there. So it's pretty scary how many fatherless boys are, quote, becoming men.
Mm-hmm. We've lost some of those nice formulas that we used to have, even with dating. I mean, it's all just kind of a free-for-all, and it does confuse the picture a lot, and people don't know what's expected of them. Boys don't know what's expected of them. I imagine girls are the same way. They probably don't know what's expected of them.
Well, and I think really, truly, it does. I'm not on a soapbox here. I'm just trying to depict what I think is actually sadly fairly normal. It isn't that the kids are as good or better than they've ever been, but they're just not being taught.
Yeah.
It doesn't come from books and tapes and seminars. It just comes one-on-one. A woman needs to teach a girl how to be a woman. A man needs to teach a boy how to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
It's been like that throughout human history. Why would it be any different now?
Well, that's a theme you see more authentically being played out in the South, I think, than you do in some of the more progressive areas. They do love tradition in the South, right? Ma'am,
yes,
they call
yeah.
you ma'am and sir and all that stuff. I love that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My kids who were Californians at first when we moved here went, "Why do these people always say sir and ma'am to you?"
I love it. Part of my family is in Atlanta, and they've raised their kids to say sir and ma'am, even though we didn't grow up with it. And, you know, it's cute. And they do love their very gender-specific roles in the South, and I think that's awesome. So the movie sounds like it's really going to be cute. Now, you're opening in Nashville tomorrow. When will it hit the theaters nationwide?
Well, we're doing a rolling release pattern, which is there's a whole new movie business out there. You know, traditionally, you'd open on 1,000 screens or something like that. And, you know, when you're a big studio and you've got a lot of muscle behind you, that's what you do. I don't think really that's economically wise when you're on the independent side. So we're rolling throughout the country. We'll be in Orange County, I think July. I'd be happy to call back when I know what those dates are. But the funny thing is, Peggy, the new movie business for independents is largely becoming retail. And for us, a big deal was Walmart. We're going to be dropping in Walmart June 2nd nationwide as a Father's Day release because it's themed around Father's Day. So for an independent, that's quite a get now. We're becoming a society of home entertainment consumers.
Well, to explain that to me, your partnership with Walmart again, how does that work? You say you're dropping in Walmart. What does that mean?
It will be on sale June 2nd across the country.
Oh, the DVDs.
Walmart.
Oh, yes, I see. So, okay. So people will be able to experience it in their homes pretty quickly
Absolutely. And this was a real scientific thing for us. We really studied this thing, and more family-oriented audiences, they're watching their movies at home. They're watching them in their minivan when they drive to Santa Barbara. You know what I mean? It makes the most sense for us.
Well, I look back on our raising our kids when they were younger, and one of my favorite memories, I mean, the things we love to do is on a frequent Friday nights, we'd get pizza and we'd rent a movie, and finding that movie was always tricky. You know what my kids got such a kick out of when they were younger was that movie, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And I remember thinking, okay, this is the standard. I want to find some more movies like this that we can all enjoy together, and there's not awkward, squirming kids getting up and walking out thinking, I don't want to watch this with my mom and dad.
I
get it.
Holding their ears and saying, don't look at this.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, right. The Secret Handshake, you can look for that in Walmart starting in June, did you say? Or July?
Yes, June the 2nd.
Okay.
Tuesday. It's a day and date release. We released this weekend and we're in Walmart on Tuesday.
All right. Well, congratulations for that. We are going to take a quick break, but filmmaker Howie Klausner is going to stay with us through the break so he can tell us about his next big project, the Ronald Reagan bioepic. This is Peggy Normandin and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic Show. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Everybody, and welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm Peggy Normandin with producer, director, screenwriter Howie Klausner, whose newest film, The Secret Handshake, opens tomorrow, but you can find it on DVD starting this summer. You can watch the trailer, as a matter of fact, on thesecrethandshakemovie.com. It's a really fun movie you're going to enjoy with the whole family. Howie, now your next big project is the Ronald Reagan bioepic film. Now, you've had some experience in documentary work. I know you did a movie about NFL players. I think it was called Outlaw Dreams, and you did a Hank Williams bio. So is this an area you really enjoy working with and turning it into a movie?
There was an old saying about Reagan, just let Reagan be Reagan, tell his story, and you really don't have to shoehorn anything in there. The man was what he was. And so I have had a fair amount of experience in adapting work as well as doing true life work to screen. So it was a natural for me, and it was a labor of love.
Well, where did you start the story?
Well, actually, we have an interesting approach, and the way I chose to do it was to take it after he had passed away, and I'm pitching you a movie now, everybody, because it's kind of the setup for the film. Okay. We actually go to, it's a leader who looks a lot like Vladimir Putin, who is making a pilgrimage out to a former KGB officer who's dying because he's a very, very old man, and essentially he wants to know the answer of why did we, as the Soviet Union, why did we lose, and the KGB man says, and the KGB man is the man who shadowed Reagan his entire career. It's based on an amalgam of KGB officers. His answer is, the question isn't why, the question is who. And so we go back and we watch Ronald Reagan's story told through the eyes of the KGB man who'd been watching him since he was in Hollywood.
Very interesting. So do you go back into his younger days then? You start when he was a young actor in Hollywood?
We start even before that. Ronald Reagan's story is the story of a man who knew from an early on that he truly is here for a purpose, and the Lord was very much in the center of that purpose. He spent his whole life searching for that purpose, thinking he'd get, like the rest of us. We go through the man's entire life, which is pretty amazing, his life, but really it wasn't until Reagan was shot, and he was laying on the table, he woke up, put his dear friend and political adversary, Tip O'Neill, over him. And he said, Tip, I know why I'm here for the rest of this presidency. You know, it's for God, whatever he wants me to do, and he meant it.
That's
a true story.
Wow. Well, do you ever, in researching and writing the screenplay, did you talk to the people that knew him? Did you ever have a chance to talk to Nancy Reagan?
I didn't with Nancy. Mark Joseph is the executive producer and just the lightning rod behind this thing. And it's his life's passion work, too. And I was so fortunate that Mark tapped me to write the screenplay. And really, he had spent 5 years doing nothing but talking talking to basically every living person left.
That's a lot of data.
It is. It's a whole lot of people. And he based the project around a couple of wonderful books by Paul Kingor that really focused on Reagan's faith as well as his politics.
Nice.
And so by the time I got to the team, you know, John Sullivan and Mark Joseph were ready to base it. They didn't dictate it to me. They said, this is the story we want to tell. And I said, I want to tell this story. Mm. So that's really how it came to be.
So we should be able to see the film, what, next year, maybe 2016?
I think there's an election in 2016. Is there?
Oh. Yeah, I think so. I think people are trying to raise a little bit of money, get a little visibility. I think I've heard that.
I'm thinking it might be a kind of timely subject.
Yeah, that's awesome. They're going to make all those candidates shudder, though, to think, oh, I have to live up to that standard.
I have to live up to this guy.
Yeah. Hey, listen, filmmaker Howie Klausner, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. I'd sure want you on my team. Good luck with your new movie, The Secret Handshake, opening tomorrow. And we can't wait for the Reagan movie to open, and we'll look forward to hearing more about that. That just sounds awesome. God bless your work, and stay in touch with us.
I sure will, Peggy. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Before we introduce our My Sainted Mother segment for today, I want to encourage you listeners to drop us a line with your comments, your questions, your suggestions, or your laundry list to Peggy@callmecatholic.com. We'd really like to hear from you. It's lonely here in the Tower of Hope, isn't it, Jimmy G?
Yeah, we need to get that feedback. You been getting some emails?
I've been getting some emails. Peggy@callmecatholic.com.
We should start a Facebook page.
Okay.
For the show.
You first.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
So now it's time for our My Sainted Mother story for the day. These are pre-recorded conversations with people recalling a memory, a moment, just a little story from their Catholic life. These are the episodes that create our Catholic culture, the seeds of our Catholic identity. And hopefully they'll remind you to share your faith with your family and your friends. Today's story certainly reflects a set of parents who infused their household with the joy and fullness of their Catholic faith. Helen remembers growing up in Syracuse, New York, in this story called The Big Catholic Family.
I really have had a blessed life in the Catholic Church, because I am the third oldest of 11 children. I have 5 brothers and 5 sisters. Really, it has been a treasured gift in my life. Everybody always knew that we were Catholics. They'd say, oh, you have 10 brothers and sisters? Oh, you must be Catholic. And we were proud Catholics. Yes, my parents were super Catholics. My mother was the president of the Altar Rosary Society, and my dad the head usher and the head of the Holy Name Society.
Holy God, we praise thy name.
And even when I was in high school, he was the head of the First Parent Guild at our Catholic high school. Being one of 11 children, we all went to Catholic grammar school. We all went to Catholic high school. We had a wonderful, faith-filled family, but our extended family was our community of St. Margaret's Church in Syracuse, New York. And we went to Mass every single Sunday, went there to school. Back in those days when everything was in Latin, my father made sure that we understood a bit of what the gospel was so that we would pay more attention when we were at Mass. But we understood what prayer was all about. Prayer was an important part of our family. You prayed together before you went to school. We prayed at every family meal. And yes, we sat down to dinner every single night.
Bless us, O Lord, and ease your gifts.
I think my parents understood ritual very, very well. And we also had some great opportunities with our friends who just loved being part of our family because of the opportunity to come together and pray. I have to be honest with you, I don't think I always appreciated it. And if you talk to any of my siblings, I think they were things that we took for granted. But I think it was our friends that really showed us that value when they would come over. And after dinner, in order to have dessert, you had to kneel down. And most nights it was the rosary or the family prayer you prayed together.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Our pastor had no extended family, so once a month on Sunday, Father McNeil would come to dinner and be with us. We learned that respect and that reverence and that ritual. As I continue to look back on my growing up days, I think of Holy Thursday and getting dressed up in your very special dress when you were younger, your first communion dress, and carrying the beautiful flowers to honor our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, the wonderful opportunities in May crowning. I remember back when I was in second grade and I got to hold the train of a young woman crowning Mary. And yes, when I was in high school, a senior, I was the person chosen to crown the Blessed Mother in my parish. Saturday nights were great times in our family because always there was a special meal, but that was a special time to get ready for Sunday. My dad would polish the shoes. He'd put those shoes out for all of us kids. My mom, she was curling her hair, ironing the dresses that were hung up. There were outfits you wore on Sunday that you didn't wear during the week. And there inside of every pair of shoes was the little envelope with a quarter in it, because sister was going to check the next day to see if you put your money in the collection. You look back with fond memories about it because your faith and family was a ritual that was so important. One of my dearest memories were family birthdays. Birthdays were so important because that was your day.
Happy birthday, dear Carolyn.
Our mother had us choose what meal you wanted. The morning of your birthday, and this was years and years we did this, you went to Mass with Mom and Dad. And I think their friends at church had something special for us. But I do remember being one of the kids at home that decorated the table, made the special breakfast for whosever birthday it was. And the giving and the receiving in that was just so important to us. The model for living the faith was my parents' fidelity to each other. Yes, they were dedicated to their children, but they were a wonderful example, not only to their own family, but to the parish family, to their extended family, of their relationship in marriage. Prayer was the binding force for them. We laughed at them. They would go out to Mass every day dressed alike, and they would put their clothes out the night before too for that, because that was so important to them. My mother went to heaven 10 days before they would have celebrated their 68th wedding anniversary. Their love for one another, even to the days when my mother didn't even know who my father was, they remained faithful and loyal to the Eucharist. And even in her not understanding what was going on around her, my mother could pray that Our Father. She knew who the body of Christ was. I think being so proud of being a Catholic, watching that example in my own parents, reminds me of a story that my father always said to us. Don't forget what your last name is, and don't forget your other last name is Catholic.
That's all for the Call Me Catholic show today. Jimmy G and I want to thank you for joining us and hope you'll return next week, same day, same time. Right, Jimmy G?
You can't get rid of me.
Thank goodness for that.
I just like the furniture. I'm permanent.
You're comfortable in it. Well, I like you being in the studio. We'll keep bringing you the good news from our good faith. So until then, I'm Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic. I gotta have faith.